If it please the court, my name is Mary Bullard. My registration number is 39382, and I represent Mr. Chris Brown in this case. Although several arguments were addressed in the brief today, I'd like to focus on an issue of first impression in Colorado, and that is namely, what are the rights of those who reside with parolees with respect to non-common areas of the residence? My client contends that those like himself who reside with parolees do have a reasonable expectation of privacy in non-common areas of the residence, particularly where they take steps to protect those areas as their exclusive domain, and therefore contends that he does have standing to address this issue.
At some point during your argument, would you please address the trial court's finding that the police had reasonable grounds to believe that the parolee consented to a search of the entire trailer, and why that isn't sufficiently supported by evidence in the record, albeit some of which is disputed, but go on as you wish.
Okay, of course, I will address that in due course. Mr. Brown further contends that because his brother, parolee Aaron Brown, did not have either common or apparent authority to consent to the search of my client's private bedroom, the officer's search pursuant to that invalid consent was unlawful. And finally, Mr. Brown asserts that his arrest in the living room several minutes after the search of the bedroom revealed drugs and paraphernalia therein cannot be justified under the search incident to arrest exception. First of all, just to address the preliminary issue, which is whether or not Mr. Brown had standing. He did have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his private bedroom, factors that the courts look at in order to determine whether or not someone has a reasonable expectation of privacy include whether someone has dominion and control over the room, their right to exclude individuals from a room, and other indicia that just are pretty much common sense.
Overlay another fact on top of that is that your client was, in his own words, on the run from a probation revocation. Does that not, and therefore somebody that wanted to be transient and did not want to establish any known residence?
I would say that the facts contradict that he in fact had used his testimony and the testimony of the parolee's girlfriend, and that testimony was not contradicted by the officer's testimony, is that he had been residing at least partially in that residence for 5 months prior to the search. In effect, his belongings at very least had been there for 5 months. And so even under the facts found by the court, which is that there was that he merely stored his clothes there and that he showered there. If he stored his clothes there and he changed clothes there, then he was at very least using it as a storage place. And there are several cases from Colorado and from the Supreme Court which recognize that a storage area is a place in which a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, the issue of Mr. Brown's probation status was not raised below, and so I believe it's not something that is fairly addressed at this point, or that the court has can fairly address at this point. However, if one looks at the cases from the Supreme Court that deal with a probationer's reduced expectation of privacy, those cases were decided where a probation officer goes into a probationer's home in order to, in furtherance of that person's probation. Here what we have is the police officers going into a parole officer going into a home in order to, in furtherance of a parolee's parole, and then almost collaterally to that, going into a room that they believe that the parolee controls, finding drugs there, and then subsequently arresting another person for the possession of the items found therein. And
I guess
at this point,
I'm not talking so much about diminished as a probationer. I'm talking about diminished as a person who had violated probation and was on the run. Isn't that a different? He was not simply a probationer. He's somebody that had no right to be on probation.
Well, they did not know that at the time, and that was not how they justified the search below. They did not know that he was a probationer until the warrant, and even then, when the warrant came back, the only testimony we have on the record that he was a probationer, that he was on the run, is his own. The officers did not attempt to justify their search of his room or of him on the basis that he was a probationer or that he was on the run or had committed any sort of offense.
If we're talking about standing, we're not talking about a justification of the search. We're talking about his threshold burden to show that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the place that was searched.
Right. If you if you, okay, if you are a, if you are, for example, charged with murder, and before that charge is complete or whatnot, you are presumed to be a person residing in a place, and therefore your relationship with that place has very little to do with your status. Basically, this person, the officer, if you, even probationers have a right of expectation, a right of to a privacy in certain areas to a reasonable extent. And while if the fact that someone may or may not be on the run from probation might be relevant, I don't think that fact was established here. And I don't think it was argued that he didn't have standing because of the fact that he was on the run.
Well, let me see if I understand this, Bullard. I think what I hear you saying is that everything hinged on whether the police at the time knew he was a probationer on the run, and whether, therefore, whether he had a reasonable expectation of privacy at the time they did the search. And
no,
if so, why? What's your...
My argument is that he had an expectation of privacy in a place in which he stored his things. And even if he was on the run, that doesn't mean that officers can go in and therefore search any place that a person might keep their things. I think that society would recognize as reasonable, unless they have probable cause to believe that there are some evidence of a crime or some evidence of the fact that he is on the run, then they would need, of course, to establish probable cause and have a warrant to show that he was on the run and therefore could enter the room for that purpose. So the fact that he is on probation, or the fact that he is, if that even is a fact, that if he is on the run, it doesn't give them grounds to then search. He still has a reasonable expectation of privacy to places in which his items are stored.
Forgetting about what the officers knew, if we look at the record in its entirety, does it establish that at the time of the search, he had violated probation and was on the run?
We have his testimony indicating that he believed that he was that he had absconded from probation at that time and was on the run.
Okay, isn't he bound by that testimony?
If he is, as I said, I don't believe that that's a determinative factor as to whether or not he has a reasonable expectation of privacy into a place in which he stores his things.
Thank you.
I would say that with regard to, it's clear here that what the officers faced when they entered the house was a closed door that had a padlock on it. Now, whether the door was locked or unlocked was controverted. Whether there was a latch or a door handle in addition to this deadbolt that's normally found on an exterior door to a house is controverted. But what we do know is that when the officers entered the house, they faced the parolee and a female, and they knew that someone else other than the parolee was inside a closed bedroom door that had a padlock on it at 8 p.m. at night. That would indicate that someone other than the parolee was behind that door. And if someone is in your home at 8 p.m. at night, there, I would say that it is reasonable to infer that that person is likely a guest in the home at the very least. And so at that point, I believe that the officers, faced with the circumstances that presented themselves, had the duty to inquire further as to the relationship of the person coming that was in that room to the room, and as to whether or not the parolee, in fact, had the authority to consent to the search of that room. And it was not disputed by the Attorney General that Aaron Brown did not, in fact, exercise common authority over the room. So the issue really comes down to whether or not there was apparent authority. And here, as was argued in the briefs, I think it is apparent that, in fact, that the circumstances that presented themselves do not justify the reasonable inference that the entire residence was accessible to Aaron Brown, or that he could consent to the search of the entire residence. And
Let me stop you there.
Okay.
Apart from the deadbolt on the bedroom door, what other facts would weigh against the parolee's consent to search any, the entirety of any residence where he might be found.
The danger we run into here is the assumption that a parolee controls every room in every house. In this case, it's clear that's not the case, because the testimony shows that, in fact, he was not in control of that room. That room was kept locked. He did not lease the residence, so he did not have a property right to control the entire residence. All we know is that he was living there. And when the officers came, what they saw was not only a deadbolt on a door, but they saw a closed deadbolt. They saw a closed deadbolt. It was 8 p.m. at night, and they knew someone else besides a parolee was inside that room, and they should have asked further questions at that time. So I think that basically, those are the facts in the record, which are undisputed, that would prompt further questions, and which it's dangerous to say that parole officers can rely simply on the consent form to permit a search of the entire residence. Basically, creates the risk that non-common areas, particularly ones as in this case, which are protected against or protected as personal spaces, will nevertheless be violated. There has to be a line which cannot be crossed, such that where steps are taken, reasonable measures are taken to protect one's privacy, that some blanket form signed by a parolee does not override that, those individual inherent rights. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. My time keeps flipping around wildly. We'll see if it resettles itself. If not, I guess you can tell me if I approach the end of my time.
I'll do so.
Thank you. I'd like to begin, I guess, just by reference to the standard of review in this case, because I think counsel and I both agreed in the briefs that the standard review for the trial court's legal determinations would be de novo, whereas it's the standard of review for factual determinations is going to be a clearly erroneous standard.
Which standard, in your view, applies to the trial court's conclusion that the officers reasonably concluded that the parolee had authority to consent to search of the entire trailer?
Your Honor, that would be a legal determination, which would be reviewed de novo, but some of the underlying facts I think are entitled to deference. For example, a fact that I think is entitled to deference is the fact that the defendant had absconded from parole and was on the lam. That was his own testimony, and that was specifically found by the trial court on page 2 of its order. So I think that's clearly a finding of fact. It's also, I think, clearly a fact based on the officer's testimony that the defendant's brother and the defendant's brother's girlfriend were the people who were allowed under the defendant's brother's parole agreement to be living in the trailer. That's clearly what the parole officer testified to. So when we talk about the rights of people, I think counsel and I both agree that parolees have a diminished interest in privacy. And people who live with parolees have an associated diminished interest in privacy. But I think that when we talk about what society is prepared to find reasonable, I think what society is prepared to find reasonable is those people who are known and have permission to be living with parolees. Because I think that there might be a situation, certainly, where, and I think that's the case in some of the out-of-state cases that I've cited, where someone is living with a parolee and has a separate privacy interest. So in terms of an expectation of privacy, I think that there might be the case that you could have a reasonable expectation of privacy in a separate area despite living with a parolee. But I think that's only a reasonable expectation of privacy if, in fact, the parole officers have been informed that there is someone living there and the parolee's gotten permission to have that person living there.
Let me follow up on that. As I understand the testimony, and I wasn't entirely clear about where in the parole agreement, I guess it would be Aaron Brown, right, needed permission to live with somebody else, but he had an obligation not to consort with people with criminal records. But let's assume that the testimony is that the parolee needed permission to live with somebody else. Where, how does that, in this case, the defendant did not need permission to live with the parolee. The parolee needed permission to live with the defendant. So if we're talking about the defendant's reasonable expectations, why, it's not incumbent on the defendant to get permission. It's incumbent on the parolee to get permission. Isn't it? Does that have any relevance to expectations of privacy that this defendant was, there's nothing requiring this defendant to get permission, is there?
In terms of an expectation of privacy, I've cited authority that an expectation of privacy has two parts. First is an actual expectation, and the defendant testified that he knew his brother was on parole and that he believed that he was able to keep his area private by giving only himself access to it. So that would be the first part of the equation. But the second part of the equation is that this expectation of privacy has to be one that society is prepared to accept as reasonable. So my response is both that I think society shouldn't find reasonable the fact that he is, doesn't, that a parolee has to state who he's living with and get permission for who he's living with. And I think we do have that testimony in the record, either in the parole officer's testimony. I think perhaps in the defendant's own testimony, he admitted that he knew he would have to have permission of the parole authorities in order to be living under the terms of the defendant, of the, his brother's parole agreement with the brother. So I think, as I said, that there's an interest of privacy that we might respect if the proper procedures had gone through and if Aaron Brown had gotten permission to live with his brother, Chris Brown. In terms of the defendant's own expectation and his status, I think it's true that we don't have information on the record with regard to the defendant's own supervision as a probationer. But as a probationer, he would also be under supervision and probably subject to search. He certainly does not have his probation officer's permission to be living in the trailer. And thus, I think it's also an interest that society is not prepared to accept as reasonable. So I think with regard to the reasonableness of the expectation of privacy, that this is just not one that society is prepared to accept as reasonable. With regard to the apparent authority doctrine, the trial court did make findings that there was both common and apparent authority. And if the defendant and the defendant's brother's girlfriend's testimony is to be believed, then that would mean that he did have had asserted a privacy interest in this bedroom, which would destroy common authority. The trial court didn't acknowledge that testimony, so it's sort of hard to know what to do with the trial court's order. The trial court found that there was common authority, but the trial court didn't address whether or not it was making a specific credibility finding with regard to the testimony of the defendant and the defendant's girlfriend with regard to keeping the bedroom locked.
I've got to tell you, I had some problems with some of the, quote, findings of the trial court. It seemed to be just made up. The only evidence is that he'd occasionally come to the residence, change clothes, and shower. I mean, there was uncontradicted evidence, I think, that occasionally he'd also be an overnight guest. What you said, there's evidence is that Aaron possessed common authority over all the areas that were searched. I don't see any evidence at the suppression hearing that would support that finding.
The only thing that could support that finding was if the trial court had found that the testimony that the defendant slept there was incredible. But as I said, that's a credibility finding that the court did not explicitly make.
So you can reject the defendant's testimony, and apparently the girlfriend of Aaron, I guess it was the girlfriend of Aaron that testified. But I don't see how you, there's no evidence that Aaron had common authority over all of it. It's indisputably a three-bedroom house or trailer, right? And it's indisputably that, undisputed, that Aaron stayed in a separate bedroom and that mom stayed in a second bedroom, and this bedroom was, I don't think there's any evidence that I saw on the record that suggested that Aaron had anything to do with this bedroom.
I'm not saying that there's any evidence in the record which suggests that he did. I mean, there was the testimony of the police officer that he recognized possessions of Aaron's in
some
the bedroom.
Movies.
Yes, some videotapes that he recognized and associated with Aaron. So there would be that. I'm not in any way saying that there is a lot of evidence which supports common authority. I'm saying that what would undercut common authority would be if those portions of the defendant's and the defendant's brother's girlfriend's testimony were found to be incredible. We don't have specific findings like that, but that is what would be necessary to support, I think, the trial court's order.
That's what you segued into reasonable belief of or apparent authority, I guess. And tell me factually, is it correct that when they entered, the door was closed and they ordered out the defendant out of this bedroom? Is that the door was actually closed when they entered?
That's correct. The door was closed. They knocked on the door, said something like, you know, police, open up. And the defendant came out into the common room. But the defendant did not at that time assert a privacy interest over that bedroom. He didn't say, hey, that's my bedroom, you can't search that.
That was disputed, although the court rejected his testimony in that, I think, pretty clearly. They didn't say he was allowed in the bedroom. But then by the time they found the gun, he'd made that all that stuff is mine comment before they found the gun. Is that right?
He did say, well, his words were, all of that shit is mine.
Yeah.
And so he made that comment during the search. But I don't think that that gives rise to saying, that's my room and you can't search it, right? That it's not the same thing. It's claiming ownership of the of items. And, you know, there may have been items both of his and of his brother's in the room, according to what the parole officer said that he was observing. But I don't think that the defendant's comment, all the shit is mine, is the same thing as asserting that he has a protective privacy interest in the bedroom.
So what facts, if you could just summarize the facts that you rely on, that even if the record were insufficient to support a common authority finding, but what facts do you rely on that the officers reasonably believed and were not required to inquire further into whether or not this was an area of common authority?
I'm relying on the parole officer's testimony. The parole officer specifically testified the defendant's brother had been given permission for the search of his residence or any premises under his control, and it was the parole officer's understanding that the brother had access to the entire trailer. He also testified
based on what facts, though? Based on recognizing the pornography? Is that
He said at the outset of his testimony, I understood that he had access to the entire trailer. I don't think that he specifically stated the basis for this belief. He just stated that it was his belief.
And in order to find this belief reasonable, don't we need some underlying, doesn't he have to explain a little more than just saying, I thought so?
Your Honor, I don't.
That belief is by definition reasonable because an officer said, I believed, and therefore it's reasonable.
I think it's reasonable under the facts and circumstances of this case because we have the fact that the parolee had given search to his residence, but we also have the fact that the parole documents demonstrated that the folks who lived in the trailer were the defendant's brother and the defendant's brother's girlfriend. So because we have that information, that these are the people that parole knows are living there, I don't think that they would have particular reason to believe that other people were living there in violation of the parole agreement. And I disagree with counsel's characterization of it as being dangerous for the police to move forward on the understanding that the people who are living in the trailer are actually those people who are allowed to live in the trailer under the parole agreement.
Your apparent authority argument, as I understand, is based on Illinois versus Rodriguez, that a reasonable mistake of fact, a search is still reasonable if they believe that, if it appeared to them that there was common authority. And I think, is that not right? Is it not a Rodriguez issue in terms of their belief, mistaken belief arguably is still reasonable and therefore not a Fourth Amendment violation?
Your Honor, I cited in my brief the Colorado cases to stand for that proposition,
right.
Peterson and White.
Okay.
So I have every reason to believe that is derived from the Supreme Court authorities you state, but I didn't cite those cases, and so I'm taking your word for what they stand for.
Under the Colorado cases that I think follow or flow from Rodriguez, isn't there it's ambiguous to clarify, the officers have to clarify and ask some questions instead of just proceed ahead, and by definition they're acting reasonably even if they're mistaken and they don't ask any questions?
Well, the statement that I set forth from White in my brief is, the doctrine is premised on points of whether a third party has consented is a question of fact, and mistakes of fact by the police can be reasonable under certain circumstances. So to the extent that the Supreme Court precedent you referenced talks about mistakes of fact, yes, we're talking about a mistake of fact. And the officers simply didn't know that information that the defendant testified to. The defendant testified, that was my room, and I kept a lock on it at all times, and I didn't let anybody else in there. But the officers didn't have any way of knowing that when they went into the trailer, right? They walk into the trailer, there are a whole bunch of people there, so they try and get them all in the living room. And the information they have is that the defendant's brother and the defendant's brother's girlfriend are the people living there. And I think they had a reasonable belief that, in fact, they could search the entire trailer based on that information.
You have about a minute left if your clock's still acting up.
I see that, Your Honor, and I believe that I've talked about both apparent and common authority at this point. I've also talked about the question of a reasonable expectation of privacy. I think that's what counsel addressed in her argument. But if this court has other questions, I have 23 seconds, and I'd love to hear them.
I think you can take the 23 seconds with you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Perhaps I'll use it on a cup of coffee later. I thank this court for its time and attention, and I hope you affirm the defendant's conviction.
If someone is on the run, his property cannot be just searched at whim. There must be probable cause to believe that there's something therein with which that is related to the offense and therefore justifies entry therein. And here we do not have that. The officers justified their search of the residence solely on the basis of a legal mistake, which was that they believed that the parole consent form was sufficient to justify their search of the entire residence. And the only facts that we have in the record that state that upon which the court could have based its belief that, in fact, the officers did have apparent authority to enter came after, in fact, the door was opened and the Officer Jones entered and believed that what he saw were items similar to what he had seen the parolee in possession of almost a year, if not more, prior when he represented him in a different city and area in Montrose County. And there again, he testified that the items, the clothing, the work tools, and the pornography were similar to items he had seen the parolee in possession of in the past. And here again, similar to, what does that mean exactly? I mean, a lot of people have similar clothing, a lot of people have similar work tools, and a lot of people have similar pornography. And so there's just not enough in the record upon which to, that there's just simply not record support for the trial court's finding that there was common authority or that there was apparent authority.
Well, let me follow up the apparent authority briefly. When the parolee meets the officers at the door to the trailer, does he give any limitations on them going into the front bedroom?
The testimony was that he allowed them into the room. It doesn't really matter if he gave them any. He did not say you can't search that room, so far as we know.
Okay,
but what we do know.
Well, then when the defendant comes out of the bedroom, he doesn't say you can't search the bedroom.
Well, he testified that in fact he did. Now all the officers testified that that was not what they heard.
And that's resolved adverse to him by factual finding.
That was resolved adverse to him by the court. However, Peterson and some other Colorado course cases hold that there's not necessary for a person who has a right to privacy in a room or in a home or in an area to object to that. The only time in which the necessity for an objection arises is where there are two parties that are jointly occupy a space and they both have common authority that is coextensive with one another's. In that case, where one person objects and the other person does not, the person who consents, who has common authority, their consent overrides unless that person objects. But where you have a situation such as the one that presents itself here, where there is no common authority, then the failure to object is not determinative and is not necessary. What is determinative is that are the facts that present themselves to the officers when they go into search. And what presented themselves here were an ambiguous set of circumstances which raised questions as to the control that was exercised by the parolee over that particular room. and therefore the officers were required to inquire further, and since they did not, the search of that residence was therefore unlawful under the Fourth Amendment. And I would also point out that the parole officer, again, he had no basis for knowing if there was anything similar because he had not supervised the parolee for at least a year, according to the record.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case.